All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Seated. Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court sitting this morning in Bannock County. We appreciate the warm welcome we've received here from Trial Court Administrator and others here in Bannock County, and we appreciate the opportunity to appear here in Pocatello for three hearings today. The first of those hearings is a matter entitled Heath versus Denny's Record Service Incorporated. That matter is case number 50549. The appellant in this matter is Tony Heath, represented by Norman G. Reese, Jr. The respondents are two, Eric L. Olson, representing Denny's Record Service, and he's assisted by Donald Sonnefeld, who's just appearing today. Another respondent, Melissa Lish, is represented by Kent Higgins, but Mr. Higgins is under the weather and has indicated that he'll submit this case on brief. With that, counsel, do either of you have any preliminary matters for the court for argument today?
None, Your Honor.
None, Your Honor.
Very well then, Mr. Reese, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to Bannock County.
Thank you.
As the court, I'm sure, is well aware, this is a very simple fact situation. I don't know that I need to dwell on the facts too much. Basically, we had two neighbors, and one neighbor thought that my client, Tony Heath, the appellant, was encroaching on her property, and so she had the cars to tow. And in fact, his car had come out over the boundary, and they were wrongfully towed. We attempted to retrieve those vehicles back from Denny's. They refused, and this lawsuit followed. I think that the main issue in this case is that of value by agreement. And I would like to start off and perhaps focus on opening remarks on the value by agreement. As the court knows, the value by agreement doctrine requires two elements. First element is you must show a boundary that is disputed or uncertain. And then if you can show the first element, you proceed to the second element, and that is you must show an agreement that subsequently fixes the boundary. And sometimes an agreement for the second element can be implied by what we call acquiescence. But I want to focus on that first element because I think it's very critical. A boundary that is disputed or uncertain. And if you will review the record, you will see that the appellees failed to show value by agreement because none of the affidavits they submitted even mention this first element of value by agreement. It's not in there. I'd like to review with you briefly the affidavits that they submitted in that regard and show you what they said. And the court will rarely see that there's nothing in there relevant to the value that is disputed or uncertain. The first affidavit the appellees submitted was the affidavit of Levi Lish. That's found in the record at pages 251 and 260. Now, the Levi Lish affidavit, it talks about an agreement to increase the height of a fence that was in back of the driveway where Tony's cars were parked. And it even talks about Levi cutting back the edge of the driveway in order to install a power line. But it says nothing about any of the elements of value by agreement. And the same holds true with Mr. Lish's corrected affidavit. That is found in the record of pages 451 and 460. The other affidavit that was submitted into the record by the appellees is the affidavit of Joey Clarkson. And that's found at 461 to 468 of the record. Here's what the Joey Clarkson affidavit says. It says the driveway was, quote, accepted, close quote, by both adjoining neighbors as the boundary. And then she claims that she and her neighbors both agreed to the fence location as a boundary. But, again, there is nothing in her affidavit as to uncertainty or dispute. Now, just based on that alone, we think that the valued by agreement defense fails. If you don't show the first element, then the second element is not even relevant. You have to show the first to be the second. Now, on the other hand, our unrebutted affidavits and our unrebutted sworn statements clearly preclude any application of value by agreement. I would first refer the court to the declaration of Michael Jensen. That's in the record of 528 to 530. Here's what Mr. Jensen said in this one statement. Now, let me back up. Mr. Jensen is one of two owners prior to Tony Heath, that will testify of what was going on during the time that Mrs. Bloxham said that there was some kind of agreement. So the first one is Michael Jensen. And this is what Michael Jensen said in his first statement. He said there was never any discussion with Bloxham about the driveway serving as a boundary. He also said there was no agreement, verbal or written, that the driveway would be the boundary.
Mr. Reese,
yes.
Does boundary by agreement require the parties to have discussed the boundary? Is that what you're contending?
What we're saying is that first and foremost, you have to show that there's a boundary in dispute, so maybe there's some discussions relative to the dispute. But you first have to have an uncertainty or a dispute before you even get to whether there's discussions about that boundary. And so our position is they never showed the first element, so we don't even get to the second. There could very well be discussions. Whether it's required or not depends on the particular facts of the case.
Is there a timing element that's part of the disputed or uncertain? For example, a lot of these cases start that there is no dispute. Everybody thinks they know where the boundary is.
Sure.
And then someone wants to put in a fence, and they realize it's off by a few feet. Then suddenly there's a dispute, but the dispute often doesn't get started until some other legal matter is being resolved.
That's true. And in a lot of those cases, there are holdings from this court that say that, you know, the understandings and so forth of subsequent owners to the property is irrelevant. It's what happened when the boundaries were created by a fence, usually by a fence. Frankly, I don't know any other cases. I love confining, and maybe, but I'm confining that talk about a driveway being a boundary. It's usually a fence. And with a long-standing fence, sometimes you get those presumptions and so forth, and you have no other explanation for the fence. And as I'll talk about here in a minute, we have a clear explanation as to why that driveway was built, plus it's marked a boundary. So, Mr. Jensen said there's
no... Let me push back on that for just a second.
Yes.
You know, this is a very narrow driveway. If I were constructing a driveway, I would have made it a little wider. The fact that it's that narrow, doesn't that suggest, it's intensely narrow, doesn't that suggest that there was some effort to keep it within a boundary of some kind?
No, because the inquiry is, I think we're on the same point here. Why was the driveway built in the first place? And secondly, was that driveway built to resolve a boundary dispute? There's a couple of two or three other cases that say that structure has to be built to resolve a boundary dispute. Now, what the record shows is this. When Bloxham moved onto the property, the driveway was already there. And I don't think any other neighbors were there, so there couldn't be any kind of dispute between joining neighbors, and therefore no agreement that, okay, we'd make this driveway a boundary.
Well, Mr. Reese, do I recall at some point that Mr. Lish removed part of the driveway?
That he did. And it was before the events led to this lawsuit transpired. And in our view, that is a destructive. Even if you give them the benefit of the doubt, that was a boundary by agreement. He destroyed it when he moved it back. And in fact,
he did what when he moved it back?
He destroyed this so-called boundary when he moved the car back. And in fact, if you look at the pictures from our surveyor and the pictures of Mr. Heath took himself in that book that's written in the record, you'll see that the edge of the driveway is right on the survey pin. The surveyor found the original pin. And so there's no uncertainty, no dispute. And we think that's the icing on the cake. But we believe that the main thrust for our argument is They had the responsibility to submit evidence of boundary by agreement. They did not because they failed on that first element. There's nothing that they submitted that said this is a dispute and it was uncertain. Heath Scott was also one of the prior owners during this time that Watson said there was an agreement. And Heath Scott said there was no agreement. There was no verbal agreement. There was no written agreement. The fence, the driveway, or any other structure would be called back. And then he adds there was no uncertainty. There was no dispute as to the location of the property. And then, of course, we submitted the affidavit from our surveyor, Matthew Baker. And he, in his affidavit, not only rebuts the so-called evidence of encroachment that was offered by the appellees, but he shows the original survey pins. And so, you know, our basic question, how can something be uncertain? You can determine it with certainty. And his survey again is in the record. We believe that the district court erred. We would affirm the magistrate's summary judgment for appellees on boundary by agreement. As we discussed, the record shows no evidence of the first element of boundary by agreement. Boundary that is uncertain when the fact shows the opposite. The unrebutted declarations of Mr. Jensen and Mr. Scott clearly established there was no uncertainty and no dispute as to the legal boundary. Uncertainty, Your Honors, is the foundational element for boundary by agreement. If you think about it, it furnishes the consideration for the agreement as to the boundary. There has to be considerations for any kind of agreement, contract 101. And if you don't have that uncertainty, there's nothing to give as consideration. And so we believe that's a very critical oversight on their part. They offered no evidence as to any uncertainty. What was the uncertainty? How did the uncertainty come about? What was the reason for the uncertainty? And so, we believe that Tony was entitled to summary judgment because the appellees failed to put evidence in the record as to an uncertain point of the boundary. And even if they had, summary judgment in favor would have been reversible error because our declarations and our expert offered affirmative evidence of no uncertainty and no dispute. And so, even the magistrate himself admitted that there was a credibility dispute. That's his exact words. It's in record 577. The magistrate admitted that there was a credibility dispute as to the existence of an agreement. And so in judgment, even when you have a court trial pending, is inappropriate where a credibility dispute is evident in the record. And that's what we have here. We think that was reversible error. But again, our position is the analysis doesn't even reach the agreement call of boundary by agreement because the FIDs did not put in the record any evidence of the boundary that was uncertain or in dispute. Simply put, you can't have boundary by agreement, and you can't show the first element of boundary by agreement. And that's the Fisher case that we cited here from 2018. The boundary by agreement argument also fails procedure as well. I think we pointed out to you in our briefing that the first assertion of boundary by agreement was in a reply brief submitted by Dennis. That's at the record in pages 4, 33, 34. And because it was put in a reply brief, a party such as Tony Heath did not have to raise a genuine issue of material fact because it was not raised in the moving party's opening brief. And we cited to you the Silicon International Court case, 2013 case. Basically says the moving party has a burden. If the moving party fails to set something forth in its opening brief, the burden doesn't shift. And that's what happened here. The appellees did not raise boundary by agreement in initial briefs before the lower courts. So the burden never shifted to Tony to show a genuine issue of material fact and to boundary by agreement. We also talked a little bit about the question of standing. The other cases on boundary by agreement consist of parties who have an ownership interest in the subject property. I'm not aware, I could not find an Iowa case where the parties asserting boundary by agreement did not have an ownership interest in the party. A stranger to the title, neither Dennis nor Wish can could assert boundary by agreement. Now it's obvious that Dennis never had an ownership interest in the property, where he's called a toad. And Wish's name appears nowhere on the ownership piece of the property. In fact, when the property was sold, her husband, Levi Wish, signed a deed as, quote, sole grantor, as his sole and separate property. and Melissa herself cited the agreement she had no interest in such a property. But the lower court went on to Red Lakes to relieve Melissa of her admission that she had no ownership interest in the property. We don't think that was proper on summary judgment. Her admissions were clear. There is nothing to construe, there's nothing to infer. I don't think it's a matter of public policy we want to have property rights determined by litigation involving strangers to the title.
Right, but this, she wasn't seeking a declaration of, you know, quiet title or anything like that. Right. She was just saying, I can't be liable on these causes of action because I believed we had a boundary by agreement.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a distinction there, right? When it's raised as a defense to a civil claim versus seeking to quiet title of the property.
This clearly is not a quiet title action. And I think really where it comes down to, is the fact that she raised that claim in her fourth affidavit. I think if you look at her fourth affidavit, that's where she brought it to, well, you know, okay, maybe my name wasn't on the title, but I certainly had a community property interest in it because I helped pay for the mortgage and so forth. But that evidence was in her fourth affidavit. We moved to strike that fourth affidavit, and the court never ruled on our motion to strike it and proceeded directly to the summary judgment, which we think is the plain error. The case is very clear that boundary by agreement must be established by clear, satisfactory, convincing evidence. And the Doe case from 2018 says that means it's evidence that the case can be proved as highly probable or reasonably certain. And again, we just don't think that the burden has the first element. And so I don't think we even get to whether there was an agreement or whether it was acquiescence. And I mean, if we did, acquiescence standing alone is insufficient for boundary by agreement. And as you pointed out, Leroy Bishop did cut back in 2010, he did cut back right to some 8 inches. And then when you look at after the cutback, if you look at before it was taken, you'll see that he cut it right back to where the deep boundary is. So several years before this happened, if there ever was a boundary by agreement, that boundary by agreement got destroyed. There's a case from the Court of Appeals, Broadhead versus Holly from 1985, not the same facts here, of course, but it just indicates that when you destroy it, but it's a boundary by agreement, you destroy the boundary.
But does cutting that 8 inches out of the driveway really destroy the boundary if the fence is still there?
Well, here's the important thing about the fence. Yeah, bear in mind that the boundary discrepancy is only at the southeast corner of the fence, and the cars were towed at the southwest corner survey pin, which is in the driveway. The fence really doesn't come into the equation here because the cars are parked by the driveway, not by the fence.
Well, and I recognize that, but my point is, if there's still an indicator that this was the line, the fact that Mr. Lish cut out 8 inches of the driveway to lay the cable, does that destroy the boundary? I mean, because according to what you're arguing, now the boundary would go like this, and then it would jog over, and it'd go back to the fence. And so I'm struggling with the argument that he destroyed it as much as he just cut part of the marker out.
Right. If you go back and look at what the record said about the fence, there's nothing that says that fence was put up other than to keep Mr. Heath's dogs off of Lish's property.
Well, but that was with respect to raising the height of the fence, wasn't it?
Correct.
Do we have anything about the existence of the fence from the time that it was installed before the height raise?
I don't think the record has anything about even when the fence was constructed. All we have is the affidavit from Jody Boxer that says she took possession of this brand new house, there was the driveway. And that's when the events brought us his transpired. But you know, whether that destroyed the boundary, we think it did, but whether it destroyed the boundary or not, the fact remains they never put any evidence into the record that there was a boundary that was in dispute or uncertainty. And that's when the office really stops from the boundary. The structure that one claims to be a boundary background has to go for that purpose. That's the Lister case from 1972. I think just a few years ago this court recognized that principle again in Owen versus Smith. So I think I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal unless there are any other questions from the court that I can answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Colson.
Thank you, Court. I'd like to go over a little bit more of the facts because I think Mr. Meese glosses over the context of this dispute. I think the record is very clear that there was a dispute between Mr. Heath and the neighbors there to the south. And he's talking about that there was never any question. The mere fact that the cars are parked right up to the now cut driveway, and their position that the cars are on their property, that therein lies the substance of the dispute right there. And so I think what he's talking about is a red herring on the elements.
Right, but the point with boundary by agreement is that there's a dispute, and then there's some resolution, and it's dispute as to the boundary, and then some sort of agreement between the parties. And so as I understand it, Ms. Lish's argument is, before my time, Bloxham and whichever predecessor to Mr. Heath had some sort of disagreement, or they were uncertain as to the boundary, and so this driveway was the boundary. So help me understand, where's the evidence of that dispute that dates back to establish the driveway was the resolution of confusion or uncertainty as to the boundary between these two properties?
Well, I would point out, with Justice Mueller's question, the dispute arose at that point in time over the cars. Now, the boundary by agreement.
At what point in time over the cars?
There in 2019, Ms. Lish kept asking Mr. Heath just to move the cars over a foot so she can access the back of her property.
But he never agreed. I mean, they may have had that dispute. That may have been a dispute about where the true boundary line was. But Mr. Heath never agreed, as I understand it, that the driveway was the boundary. And so then you don't have the second element of boundary by agreement. Plus, as I understand it, when you get to the acquiescence element, if that's how you're going to prove an agreement for element two, it's got to be 5 years. And so if the dispute arose in 2019, I don't know how you had the 5 years of acquiescence.
Well, what I wanted to point out is certainly it was a dispute there. The fence had been placed there when the property was constructed. The record shows that. With respect to that issue. With respect to Denny's record, we don't know that that issue is material for our issue in this case, but just wanted to provide the context of the driveway showing a clear boundary. The fact that it was cut, I don't think that destroyed the boundary that was set there and agreed upon by predecessors in interest of Mr. Heath. And also Mrs. Fox and the subsequent property owners, the militias. And so with respect to that key issue, I think you have the necessary question come up to show that that was the agreed upon boundary amongst all the owners up until that point in time.
Which owners? When you say it was an agreement among all the owners.
All the owners.
Who?
History. Mr. Heath's predecessors, also Mr. Liss's. Mr. and Mrs. Liss's predecessors.
And so where's the evidence in the record that there was a dispute between or an uncertainty between them as to the boundary?
Well, with respect to that, it wasn't ever questioned. And that was the time.
But is that enough? I mean, the fact that somebody builds a fence not on the boundary line, and that's just the way it is. Does that satisfy boundary by agreement?
Yes, I believe so.
And my struggle with that is you could have a fence company make a simple error in where they cite the property line, and that's enough to give property to a neighbor. I mean, I'm not sure that that's what boundary by agreement stands for, is that somebody makes a mistake where they build something and that's enough to convey property.
Well, maybe certainly at the time, but when it's discovered and what the parties do and their subsequent actions and recognizing the fence as the boundary between the properties raises that to a higher level, then it does become as such.
So I asked the question at the very beginning of this hearing about the timing. Obviously, the first element of boundary by agreement can either be disputed or uncertain. In a case like this where you have a subdivision that was created 30, 40 years ago, maybe not that long, and you have two properties, and you have two garages or parking areas, and the parties aren't sure exactly where the line is between their property, and so they just agree, we'll just put it right in the middle, or where we think the middle is, because neither one of us want to pay to have it surveyed. Does that constitute an uncertain boundary and meet the first element?
I think so.
I mean, a lot of times in rural areas, these fences are just put there as an approximation, and then they become the accepted boundary. Does the evidence in the case support that kind of interpretation, that neither party wanted to pay for a survey, so they just put it where they thought the middle was? It turns out they may have been off a few inches.
Yes. You can see there's been some dispute. We've malicious provided evidence from the county tax department about the lines, and the county themselves say what we show on the cadastral maps or the overlay may or may not be. You're going to have to get that, and it's up to the parties. Well, just like you said, do we want to go through that time and expense, or do we say here's our best estimate, we'll live by it? So I think that is the evidence that's apparent in this case.
And I'm not seeing anything in Bloxham's affidavit about who built the fence or how they decided where to build the fence. All I see her saying is, we and the neighbors at the time agreed to the location of the boundary fence. But I don't know how that agreement came about. I'm struggling because I think there is a distinction between Justice Mueller's situation where, hey, you live here, I live here, we don't know where the boundary is, let's just put a fence in the middle, versus I've hired someone to come and build a fence and I trusted them to put it on the property line and they didn't.
Well, you have two parties there that put up the fence, both benefit by it. And I think it's implied from the situation when you put it up as adjoining neighbors.
But she doesn't even say that. I don't know.
Understood, but I just think that's common sense. That's what happens. Whether you say that there's a specific act in the record, that's the real-world implication of this situation in property owners and putting fences up.
And so if I hire someone to put a fence on the boundary of my property and they put it a foot into my lot because I didn't go out and find the pins myself and confirm that they put it in the right place, I'm now bound to give a foot of my lot to the neighbor?
Understandably, there are extreme situations, like you would point out. But when it's best estimate, it goes over the line a little bit here, a little bit there, I think that's what the law intended to encompass here. Those type of agreements, whether it's in a rural setting or in a subdivision. So, with respect to that, the facts in this situation, Ms. Lish asked on multiple occasions just to have the cars moved over. Denny's record came in after Mr. Heath refused to be a good neighbor and just to move the property over so she could gain access to her back lot. Now,
and what do you mean by gain access to the back lot? Because the reason I ask that is, you know, as Justice Mueller pointed out, that driveway is very narrow. But it goes back to basically the chain link fence that goes across and the shed that's right behind it. So what is she trying to get access to? Parking along the...
She had a RV trailer that she had parked in front of her property because the way the door swung, okay, the gate to the backyard swung, it came over and hit the vehicle. And you can see that from the pictures in the record. She couldn't get the gate all the way open to then back up an RV trailer, about a 20 or 30 foot trailer. into the backyard.
Could she get anything into the backyard? That's my point.
She could get some things into the backyard, but not the main intended piece, which is the RV trailer.
And how does all this discussion affect your client's liability under 49-1806?
Well, it goes to the background that Ms. Lish provided to Deanne Wilson of Dennis Record. Okay? So, Ms. Lish tried to ask Mr. Heath, as a good neighbor, hey, can you please move your cars over? Those things, those requests were rebuffed. She then spoke with Officer Aaron Harper, who has an affidavit here in the record, who is Chubbuck City Code Enforcement, to go and ask them to say, hey, at the time those cars are on my property, I can't have full access to my backyard. This is the way the gate swings open, and put my RV trailer back there. The RV trailer out in front could only be parked there a certain amount of time before she ran into her own code enforcement. So, just the context of the situation, Ms. Lish was trying to comply with the law to get her RV off the front property and put it back where they had constructed the shop and the parking pad to do so. So, that goes to the reasonableness of Denny's record in assessing the facts and circumstances here, as found in here, Idaho Code Section 49-1806, Print 1. Because Ms. Lish came to Denny's record and sought to exercise her civil right to have property removed that is standing on, or having a car removed that is standing on her property. And Idaho Code 49-1806, Print 1, provides the authority of the property owner, Ms. Lish, and Levi Lish, to have that civil remedy when all other reasonable attempts to resolve the issue have failed. So, specifically, Mr. Reese didn't talk about the evidentiary deficiencies. He had objected to the affidavits of Deanne Wilson and Aaron Harker. I will lead to the briefing on that front. I think Judge Thompson accurately ruled that the applicable exceptions to the hearsay rule for business records were met, and that those affidavits provided the support that he needed to make the determination that Denny's record was reasonable in relying on Ms. Lish's representation and the evidence that she had provided to him. So let's talk about the summary judgment piece. Both claims that Mr. Heath has brought, whether it's a civil trespass or conversion, have very critical elements that weren't met in this case. Specifically, under the trespass statute, Idaho Code 6-202, there has to be a wrongful or unauthorized access to the property. And then, with respect to the conversion claim, there has to be an unlawful possession of the property. What we're talking about here are two junk cars, which he parked right up to the sideway, right up to the cement driveway. And with respect to that, Idaho Code 1806.1 says that any person having control of the real property and who finds an unauthorized vehicle standing on his property is permitted to have the vehicle removed or booted if it is posted on or near the property in a clearly conspicuous manner, a large print, a sign, or notice the unauthorized vehicle will be removed. Ms. Lish came to Denny's record and provided the information that Ms. Wilson put in her affidavit as to the location of the cars, asked for the appropriate signage, posted the signage on the property, and then came and asked Dennis Record to remove the cars. And specifically, Idaho Code 4918.06 provides the authority of Denny's Record to come in and provide that remedy to Ms. Lish. Specifically, you know, that Title 18 provides a well-reasoned, well-thought-out public policy that allows a record services within the bounds of those rules to come in and provide that service. Now, with respect to Denny's Record, at the time that they looked at the evidence provided by Ms. Lish and assessed the situation, it appeared to them that the cars were staying on Lish's property and that the requirements of 4918.06 Prend 1 were met. And as we see here in other prior Supreme Court precedent and subsequent cases that have relied on that precedent and Peasley Transfer, this is very similar to the sheriff in Peasley Transfer who was exercising their authority under a writ of execution. Here, we had Denny's Record Service that was allowed to go and tow the cars. They had the authority to do so under the Idaho statute, and therefore them coming on to Mr. Heath's property and removing the cars couldn't have been a civil trespass because they were specifically authorized. And that's specifically called out in Idaho Code 6-202, Prend 7, sub Prend B and C, when they're either have authority or authorized to do so. And so as such, the claim for trespass cannot be found. And similar with respect to conversion, he cannot prove that essential element there. They had the right under the statute to remove the cars, and so their possession of the cars was proper. Mr. Heath specifically had the ability to go and receive his cars back by paying the towing fee and the storage charges that had incurred on them, but he refused to do so. And so he failed to avail himself of that remedy that is laid out in the public policy in Title 18 Chapter 18 of Title 49. And so, what is Denny's Record supposed to do at that point in time? Now, the fact that Mr. Reese wants to come back to is that, well, 2 years later, we had this survey. And after the fact that it was still not specifically shown that it wasn't on his property, because I think you see in Lish's appellant brief, they still believe it's on the property, notwithstanding the survey. But specifically in Peasley Transfer, a law doesn't require Denny's to go and conduct a survey before they go and remove the property. And so that claim is irrelevant. Mr. Heath has also argued that a tort is still a tort even if you didn't mean to do it. Judge Thompson did find that Denny's Record acted reasonably and appropriate under the circumstances, but they did so under the color of law. And it wasn't just their state of mind or their belief that they thought that they were acting appropriately. So I think those claims are unfounded.
Does your analysis change at all as to your client if we were to reverse the grant of summary judgment in favor of Ms. Lish and send it back and say there is a genuine issue, material fact, on boundary by agreement?
I would say no.
And explain that for me.
Right. Well, at that point in time, with the information known at that time, there was a reasonable belief that the property was standing on the Lish's, or the cars, the junk cars, were standing on the Lish's property. And I think without absence of other information that there was fraud or collusion or some other untoward act that didn't show that this was a facially valid or an appropriate tow, then I think it doesn't matter what the facts ultimately show. Because to have that kind of public policy would mean that that type of civil remedy for people in these situations would never be exercised in my review of the situation.
And while your client may not, I understand what you're saying, your client acted in good faith based on this malicious representations. And so while your client may not be liable on Mr. Heath's claims, if there was a determination, if we reversed it, set it back, and there was a determination, there's no boundary by agreement, and so Ms. Lish wasn't, the cars weren't on her property, at that point your client would need to release the vehicles, right? Because it would no longer have a legal basis to hold that.
No, I think that easily transfer, that would be the wrong analysis. Easily transfer specifically provides, more or less, if we acted under the law, under a fact we believe to be true without other factors to call it into question, that decision is given effect. And we don't Monday morning quarterback that.
Right, and I'm not talking about Monday morning quarterbacking, but if at some point after that you become aware that the court has declared no, those weren't on her property, she didn't have a right to order them towed, what is the basis for your client to continue to hold the cars?
Well, the basis is Chapter 18, Title 49. That's just the program that allows the cars to be towed and the owner to be liable for the charges. And it wasn't any untoward or wrongful action at that point.
Okay.
And so are you saying he has some kind of possessory lien and his fees for storage until such time as they're paid?
Exactly. And that's what the statute provides. And we do have a possessory lien and we can sell the property. Since there has been a dispute, we're still in possession of those two cars.
It strikes me, though, that if there's a court determination that they weren't on her property, your client may not be liable for the acts taken prior to that, but in terms of the possessory lien and the storage, she would then be liable.
Well, if the court shut down that later on. But we just take the fact that whoever is the owner of the property, whether Ms. Lish's actions were right or wrongful, then, you know, we would have to comply with the court order to that effect. And would do so. The remaining issue here is that based on Judge Thompson's finding as Denny's record as a prevailing party, it awarded costs and fees, attorney's fees, to Denny's record. Specifically, the record shows the authority under the trespass statute and also Idaho Code 12120, Part 1, to award those fees and costs. We have Mr. Reese tries to say that the trial court abused its discretion. Judge Brown reviewed that, said that all the factors had been reviewed pursuant to Rule 54-3. It's our contention that we as Denny's Records don't have to provide all information, but provide sufficient information so that the court can review all those factors and that it properly did. We also provided on appeal that we believe that Judge Brown's reduction in our fee award due to the computer-assisted research was an error because he had put in a footnote that specifically Judge Thompson didn't address that factor. However, I think that on totality, all the information was provided and that Judge Thompson appropriately reviewed the record and made a sound decision. We also are seeking attorney's fees and costs on this appeal. If we are the prevailing party, you have to look at this case and look back at this neighborhood dispute that continued on, notwithstanding that the leashes moved away. Mr. Heath had the ability to get his cars back by paying $1,500 in towing costs and rental that's capped. Doesn't sit there and keep on going. He had the ability to do so. We believe that the trial court acted within its bounds of discretion on well-reasoned legal analysis and advice, and that the district court, Judge Brown, acting in that appellate capacity, so found and affirmed that finding. And we ask that that continue to be the case. I believe Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
12 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Reese.
Thank you. I don't feel we required to use all those 12 minutes, but just by recap, the Chief Justice required us to be put in the ability of Section 49-1806 of the Federal Code, and we just started off with a few observations in that regard. First of all, as to why that section does not apply in this instance to give them immunity, I would refer the court to our reply brief, pages 18 through 21, where we talked about why the statutory amendment itself, A, does not apply to Melissa Lish, and B, does not afford Denny's immunity to claims under that statute. I'd also refer the court to the record at page 569. There, the magistrate said that the cars did not encroach Lish's property. And then he went on to say the boundary by agreement applies. But he says that as of today, without the boundary by agreement, as of today, those cars did not encroach her property. And if they didn't encroach the property, they certainly could not have been standing upon her property, to use the language of the statute. It might also be of interest to the court, and again, an affidavit submitted by appellees. If you look at Aaron Parker's affidavit, particularly at the record of page 321, Aaron Parker said this, when he was looking at the situation and trying to figure out who the cars belonged to and so forth. At the record of 321, Officer Harper said, I was not able to inspect the VIN number because the vehicle was on private property. That's pretty significant. See, he's called there by Melissa Lish because she says there's a problem. And he says, I couldn't inspect the VIN because those cars were on private property. And I think that coupled with this trespass statute shows that Denny's certainly did not act reasonably in towing these cars. We cited to you in our pub briefing numerous parts of America where pictures show those cars in the language of the trespass statute had to have been to a reasonable person associated with Tony's property. The trespass statute says that a person commits a civil trespass upon entering another's property without permission, quote, or with reason to know that his presence is not permitted, close quote, where that, quote, property is reasonably associated with a residence, close quote. And I think that Officer Harper's observation just confirms that in this case, Denny's cannot avail themselves of what they think is an immunity in 49-1806, nor can they hold themselves immune from trespass because those cars, and if you look at the pictures again, a reasonable person is going to know that those cars are reasonably associated with a residence.
Mr. Reese, yes. You think they're arguing immunity? I hear their argument as they reasonably rely on the statute to say, we believe she's established these are on her property and therefore she has a right to ask us to come tow them. I don't understand them to be saying 49-1806 gives them immunity.
The equipment is a fence.
Right, but they acted reasonably because they believed she had the right to ask them to do this under a statute.
In our view, yes. And in our view, that defense fails because, again, look where the cars were. That's what they were seeing. A public officer, Aaron Harper, saw the same thing and said, at least this is one of those cars. That's not private property. I can't enter there to look at it again. So
well,
I think there's a problem. At least one of those, not both.
Well, Mr. Reese, both of the car, whether the cars were completely on Mr. Heath's property or partially on the Lish property, it was all private property, correct?
It was all private property, yes.
And so the policeman saying, I can't go onto private property to check the VIN, is a different issue, is it not, from Denny's Wrecker relying on a statute that gives authority to go onto private property when, in his belief, the car was partially on the private property of the person saying it shouldn't be here. Isn't there a difference there?
Well, I think that what Officer Parker's comments came in the context of him being requested by militias to come and look at cars. So I think he had their permission to be on their private property. I think what he was saying was, I couldn't cross that property line to look at the VIN numbers because it was clearly on Tony's private property.
Well, no one has ever claimed that the cars were totally on the Lish property, correct?
Right, and therefore they could be standing on it.
If they were partially on the Lish property, they couldn't be standing on the Lish property?
We don't have that situation here because the magistrate acknowledged that having made a decision, they were not on Lish's property. And the best thing they could do is with the district judge's observation said they were, quote, extremely close to the property. So there's nothing in the record that shows that they were on Lish's property. I in regards to the affidavits, as counsel for the affidavits has said, I will also refer the court to our briefing. I think it's really important, though, to point out that, as we did in the briefing, that where they tried to do the business records exception to hearsay, they did not meet the elements. They did not set forth the elements in the affidavits. They should have been stricken on that part. But there's even a more basic problem with several of their affidavits, not all of them. And that is where they submitted affidavits, quote, on knowledge and belief. Now, Rule 56 is very clear. Affidavits are to be made on personal knowledge, period. And when...
Why can't belief be based on personal knowledge?
Well...
This is what I know, and therefore I believe this fact to be true.
Yeah. The problem is, if you say, I base this on knowledge and belief, and that's the very first part of the affidavit. You don't know what statements in the affidavit are based on personal knowledge and which are based on belief. Now,
isn't that just a question of foundation?
Well, I think personal, it is a question of foundation. You've got to have a foundation for what you're putting in the evidence on summary judgment. Now, if you could say, for example, well, this is why I think this happened, that might be something else. But where you say, everything in this affidavit is based on my personal knowledge or belief. That's way too broad. You don't know what's personal life, you don't know what's belief.
But I don't think that's the point. The point is, as you read statement by statement in the affidavit, is there foundation for it or not? I'm struggling with why that introduction has any impact. I mean, people can say that, and then if they put a bunch of conclusory statements without any foundation, the fact they put this is based on personal knowledge doesn't solve the foundation issues.
It does solve the foundation problems, and that's why a lot of them, in addition to being lacking on the personal knowledge, also lack on the fact that they were conclusory and stating facts that they did not show they had personal knowledge about.
But isn't that just like precatory language that, I don't know, through tradition, whatever, lawyer forms. I put it in the same category as further affiant saith not. I mean, where did that come from?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I know. I don't know if it goes in my head.
I know. I don't say it either because I figure
right.
I want to leave the door open for my client to say, but, you know, I mean.
Sure. But I think you have to be careful.
Agreed.
When Rule 56 says, it shall be based on personal knowledge, period. Okay? And I think that maybe we've got a little last days ago when we put our ideas. I know I have. But when you look at the cars in the road, now, other rules, I think Mr. Higgins pointed out too that the procedure rule 54 does not have a personal knowledge requirement. And I think in that case, something like that information would be fine. But 956 says personal knowledge, and that's what it means. So, it really puts, a responding party in predicament because you can't tell what the person person like you can't tell what to believe. As to the attorney fees matter, I will simply refer you to pages 21 and 23 of our reply brief. Again, we believe that all the factors of Rule 54 and 83 need to be addressed, and that was not done. In fact, the factors that could only have been provided by counsel were provided by the judge, and we believe that was a personal error. And that the information the judge put in the record was really boilerplate, right? It was really applied to the particulars of this case. I think when Rule 54 and 83 came about, the desire was that we would have attorney input as to what those factors asked for so that the court could analyze the reasonableness of the fee request. For example, as to the time limitations element of 5483, although the magistrate said, I'll supply it for Gaines, and he says, quote, Gaines was sued by Tony and obligated to defend itself or face default or defeat. Close quote. Well, so they used any case. As to the undesirability case, the court again supplied what Gaines failed to provide. That said, quote, Denny's do not want to be sued for transacting its normal business operations. Well, you can say that about anybody. No, no, just gets sued because of the business transaction. So we just go back to the error. There was a reversible error by not applying all or not analyzing all of the 54B3 factors because there were some factors that only the attorney could provide. They were not provided. We think that the court erred in providing them rather than requiring counsel to do that. And so that should be reversed as well. So unless you have any further questions, I thank you for your time today and for the suggestion of our briefing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reese and counsel. Appreciate your comments and argument today. This matter is now under advisement. We will have a decision in due course. Stand in recess for approximately 10 minutes.
All rise, please.